This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. We are at NDC Oslo. I'm talking to Robert Freeberg. And so, Robert, what did you speak about?
Well, I did a little presentation about in-memory databases, and I compared an open source project called OrigoDB with Redis and SQL Service Hackathon.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so yours is the open source project?
Yeah, obviously. So, yeah, I'm working on an open source project called OrigoDB. And
how's that spelled?
Origo, like Origo.
Okay.
Yeah? O-R-I-G-O.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. But I figure I've got to change the name because no one really understands it. But
Okay, so it's an in-memory database. Well, first of all, why did you feel the need to write your own in-memory database when there's others available? Or?
Well, there's nothing really similar.
Okay.
And also, we've been doing this for a long time, so there wasn't anything out there at the time we started out.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in-memory, is this a standard relational database like I'm used to, or NoSQL, or what kind of?
Well, no. When you go in memory, you're not really constrained by how you represent data on disk.
Okay.
Yeah, because data on disk, disk is usually block devices, spinning metal. Mm-hmm. And you have to represent the data in a friendly way to get it on disk and back into memory. And that's also true with SSDs. They're backed by flash memory, but they're exposed as block devices, so they have the same kind of interface.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but when you put data in memory, you can kind of take advantage of the random access nature and use different types of collections and pointers and stuff, more graph-oriented than stream-oriented, like you would do on disk, yeah.
Okay. So if I've got, am I thinking about this just like an in-memory structure? Like, is it ACID? Is the data going to be there if I shut my machine off, or is it just a cache?
Well, it's persistent. The data is in memory in any representation you like, and then you log the transactions. So every time you make a change, you capture the transaction, you write it to a log. And you can write it to disk, or you can write it to a SQL. You can write the events to the commands to a SQL or an event store.
Okay.
Or whatever.
So it's written out as a log. So in order to kind of get my state back, let's say my application starts up, right? Does it take, is it instantaneous? Is there a snapshot, or does it just replay the event list, or what's going on?
Yeah, well, it looks for the most recent snapshot. So you can do snapshotting, and then it replays the events from the snapshot on.
Okay.
Yeah. But you could have millions of events, and it could load pretty fast.
Okay.
Yeah, it depends on kind of the format. You can choose the serialization format, and you can have JSON. You can use binary formatter, or you could use protobuf.
Protocol
buffers from
exactly.
Google, yeah.
Yeah, those are popular, and I think part of it they're fast and very
yeah. They're
very
fast.
Small.
They're compact, and they're also interoperable.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you could use communicate from different platforms.
So, trying to think about where I would best apply this. Is this something that, does this replace my standard database I'm using in a web application, or is it more useful on a service, or, where's the sweet spot for this?
Yeah. Well, let's look at the problem. We kind of built it from a problem. I look at software today and I see we're doing things in perhaps not an optimal way. So if you look at a database, you put things in it and you ask it things. You query it, right? So you put data and you query. And queries are slow in most databases that are disk-based, so we have to put a cache in front.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Right. So a cache isn't like an optimization. It's kind of because it's kind of a symptom that our databases are too slow.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one way of just turning it upside down and doing it, right?
Yeah. So you end up having to architect around, I'm dumping a bunch of data in one place, and then I'm maybe having another reporting database or another, I process or I cache it in my database layer, or I have Redis or something else to actually use the data.
Yeah. So the traditional relational database, it was great during the 80s when we had tiny amounts of memory available mm-hmm. and pretty small amounts of disk as well, and everything was slow. It was just, you had to do it that way. You had to figure out some way to get portions of the data in memory and try to answer queries, right?
Right. But
that's not really the case today, because we have a lot of memory available.
Mm-hmm.
So most data sets will just fit in memory.
Okay.
Yeah. And also, if you do a relational model, that's kind of a domain model, right? During the 80s, when you did relational modeling, entity
right.
relationship modeling, that was kind of like the ubiquitous language.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like a DDD, but
yeah.
for a long time ago, because the SQL was designed for end users, almost, right? Business users. They could, like, type
oh,
queries,
right.
right?
Yeah.
Go to the user table,
essentially, and edit some users.
Yeah. I think that was one of the ambitions with the language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when we're doing a relational database and then we're doing object relational mapping, well, first we're doing domain modeling once at the storage,
yeah.
right? And then we're doing mapping to something in memory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the data in memory. That's where we do our computations, right?
Right.
Yeah. So if all the data fits in memory, why do we have a duplicate model?
Why bother?
Yeah, why yeah. bother? Yeah. So it's kind of a my time as a developer. I have to develop two models, and I have to map data. I have to do a mapping between the two models, because one is optimized for storage on disk, and the other one in memory is optimized for computations or queries.
Right.
And then there's a mapping in between, and there's a lot of problems with that, right? You see problems. People have performance problems with object relational mappers.
Right.
Yeah, and there's also complexity dealing
it's
with transactions.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're pulling data into memory, or pieces of data into memory. You're operating on them, and then you're pushing them back.
Mm-hmm.
And the transactions are prolonged. If you just keep all the data in memory and you perform the transactions in place, then the code and the data are in the same place. And everything's so fast, because reading memory is like 167,000 times faster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Random access. So you can do everything single-threaded. So you don't have to do locking or latching. You just execute transactions one at a time. And on my laptop, I can do like 50,000 transactions per second. And those are persistent ACID transactions.
Now, if I'm keeping all the data in memory, what is the difference between that and just maintaining a large data structure right in my application?
Well, that's really what you're doing.
Okay.
So that's what the server does. It maintains a data structure that you define using .NET collections
okay.
or types. Yeah, so you create a container and you put perhaps sorted dictionaries of customer objects or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, whatever model you like, you just project it into memory, and that's your database. And then you do link queries against them, grab
okay.
data, yeah.
And the advantage that you add to this is that I've got things like snapshotting, and I can trust
yeah.
my data is going to be there, and I don't have to deal with serializing it out and restoring it back and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And then we have a server product as well. So we have an embedded engine. Just grab it on NuGet. It's
mm-hmm.
OreoDB.core. And then you can run the engine in your process, like
okay.
in an IIS process. And then the data is right there with your web application. But if IIS recycles or your thing goes down, then your database is down. And then when it goes back up again, you have perhaps a restore time
mm-hmm.
to reload the snapshot and so on.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you run out of process with the server product, you get clustering. So we have master-slave replication.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can load balance. You can do reads at the different slaves.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can set up an asynchronous slave.
Ah, okay.
Offsite, just for offsite storage.
Yep.
And that kind of thing.
And how are those different slaves communicating? Is it like TCP or like?
Yeah, it's TCP. I work a lot with SQL Server.
Okay.
That's kind of my background. And I was kind of inspired by mirroring, database mirroring feature in SQL Server. So I kind of looked at that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just piping over the commands over a TCP connection.
Ah,
yeah, from
okay.
from the master to the slaves, and synchronously. So it pushes pushes each command as it arrives in parallel to each slave, and then just waits for the ACK.
Okay.
Yeah, before it commits.
So then my master goes offline. My application's able to just switch over to one of the slaves then?
The application will switch over, but there's no automatic failover like in a leader election. So right. a new master takes over the role. One of the slaves takes over the role of master automatically. We haven't really tried that yet because we'll probably fail at it. I'm still learning distributed systems, but you can do
it. It's a hard problem, right?
Yeah, it's a hard problem, pretty hard problem, yeah. So at the moment, you can do manual failover.
Okay.
So you have a web-based UI, so you go into one of the slaves and you promote it to master.
So the slaves, like the web UI is actually running inside the database, and I'm able to just log into it and control.
Yeah, it's an administration interface built with Bansi. It's not really polished yet, but it gets the job done.
It allows you to do the important things, right?
Yeah, we have two cool features, though.
Okay.
And one is that you can, in the web-based UI, you can create Razor queries that work immediately with the data. Yeah, so you can just type them in and save them, and you can execute them.
So it's a Razor query, meaning I'm typing a CSHTML file.
Yeah.
Or CSH, Razor code.
Yeah, Razor. Yeah.
And it's into a text box, basically?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
So I'm using Razor so that I can, that's cool. So I'm actually controlling the formatting and the querying. Querying's just C#, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's basically just so I can do administrative type of queries with some cute display
as well.
Yeah, it's not for building applications
right.
at all. Yeah. And then we have bindings for JavaScript. So everything is built with C# and it's all .NET.
Mm-hmm.
And we communicate binary protocol. And by default, it's binary formatter. That's formatting the messages, the commands and queries that you send to it. And that's not really open to other platforms. But if you use protocol buffers, protobuf, then that's an open format. Then you could, in principle, from Java, create a Java application that opens TCP connection and formats a message, a command or query using protocol buffers. Yeah, and get some data back.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then with that, I could be using it in a mobile application or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Potentially.
But we have JavaScript as well. So we have an over HTTP, you can send messages in JSON format. You get JSON back.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And the only thing you do with your data in memory is you define commands and queries. Those are the only operations. You define your own commands, give them a name and some parameters. It's kind of like a stored procedure if you do SQL. So you pass the command to the server and it will execute it.
And it's a command I've defined.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So there's no ad hoc writes. You can do ad hoc reads, and that's using link. So you can pass in link as text, and it will get compiled on the fly and cached based on the hash code.
Okay.
And even parameterized. So that's pretty cool. I think link is a really powerful language, link to objects.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more expressive than SQL, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Trying to think, how much memory is this going to take? I guess it just depends how much I throw in there, right? How much data is this?
Yeah. Oh, well, you'd be surprised how much data you can fit into memory. Because if I look at the projects I've been working on for the past 20 years, not a single one of them had more than 100 or 200 gigabytes of data.
Yeah.
If you look at transactional workloads.
Right.
Right. So those will easily fit in memory. You can get an Azure instance with about 112 gigabytes. It'll cost you a bit to have it up all the time, right?
Yeah.
And you can get one on Amazon for 244 gigabytes. That's pretty. That's a lot of data.
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not really for big data or analytics.
Sure.
But 250 gigabytes. That's a lot of data.
And I could have a relational database that I'm using more to store long-term data, and then I could have both available in an application too, right?
Yeah. There are various ways to integrate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
So you mentioned the server as a product. Is this a commercial product then?
Yeah, we're kind of experimenting with different kinds of revenue models because I'd like to make a living doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but mostly I'd like to share a new way of thinking, just trying to introduce this way of keeping data in memory and working off that because it's not really a complex product, right? So this is kind of sharing the idea. And doing stuff in memory that I like. And there are other products that take advantage of that as well. But we tried a revenue model, but we have zero sales, right, of the server product.
Okay.
Yeah. And but we made the decision that the next version that we're working on is going to be entirely open source, even the server product. So it's open source and a free. Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Yeah, so we're going to try to build a support.
Okay.
Yeah, support licenses.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're pivoting to that.
You mentioned you've been using this at work. What are some examples of applications that people have built with this?
Oh, okay. Well, I did a consulting job, and I was very fortunate to be able to evaluate our product on this project because they were having enormous problems. It was a big project in Sweden with healthcare.
Okay.
And it was pretty neatly architected. It was Silverlight clients.
Okay.
And they were passing, it's a rich client, but they were passing commands to the server, and we had WCF services, and then we, at the service layer, the services were consuming business components, right? And each business component was creating one or more data components. And the transaction involved many business components and many data components and many round trips to the database per data component.
Yeah.
Yeah, and everything was like trapped in a big transaction. And the transactions were really complex as well. So the data access wasn't simple data accesses, but they were using cursors.
Oh, no.
And user-defined functions with cursors and joining.
Oh,
so it was terribly complex also on the server side. But the domain really demanded that kind of complexity. And the performance, it was just way off.
Yeah.
It was crazy out the door. They couldn't do anything about it. I traced some of the transactions. They could make like thousands of database round trips.
Wow.
Yeah, per transaction. Yeah. And they had a requirement of max 3 seconds. Yeah, that was like an absolute requirement. Worst case, 3 seconds per transaction.
For thousands of database connections.
Yeah, so I did a proof of concept, and we rewrote the entire domain model using just C# types and collections.
Okay.
Yeah, and stuck an instance of that in memory. And then we just ran the transactions in memory, and then we could like do, tens of thousands per seconds, and
wow.
All the problems they just went away immediately. Yeah, and then, and every
tens
time
of
we
thousands of transactions per second.
Yeah, so it's the only thing that limits you. Well, depending on how complex the transactions are, it could be computationally expensive. But the limiting factor is always the disk, right?
Okay.
So you're appending a transaction to the journal.
Yeah.
Yeah. The SQL Server appends data pages, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you commit a transaction in SQL Server, all the new pages or modified pages, new pages, original pages, deleted pages are part of the transaction and they're written to the log. So it's a lot of data, a lot of bytes, data pages getting written to the log.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when you just log the transaction, the operation, it could be just a few bytes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's only what was the operation and what were the parameters.
Yeah.
So that's what you log.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's the defining factor for performance.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And then as I'm taking snapshots, does it keep a list of a certain number of snapshots on like I would think the snapshots are actually maybe the largest part, right, that I'm holding?
I try to avoid snapshots.
Okay.
Yeah, because they're pretty cumbersome. When you're taking a snapshot, you need a read lock on the database. You can't do transactions at the same time you're reading. Unless you're using an immutable model with multi-version concurrency control. We support that as well.
Cool.
Yeah. But if you don't, taking a snapshot takes a bit of time, and it takes a bit of time to restore. And restoring a snapshot, it has to tie together all the relationships between the objects, because if you have a complex object graph, and that's not linear to the transactions in runtime.
Okay.
It's more complex. It's probably quadratic.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's slow. Could be slow restoring a snapshot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And if you have if you put a snapshot in, you can truncate the transactions prior to that snapshot.
Okay.
Right? But then you're losing information because the transactions are kind of like your history, the total history of what's happened in the system.
So it's important data as well. It's not just what's the data state, but how I got to that data state.
Exactly. Yeah. So everything that's true of event sourcing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The listeners probably have heard of that.
Oh, yeah.
Event sourcing and everything Greg Young's saying about that, the complete history of events. Mm-hmm. It's all true here as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So in your talk, what sort of things did you show off?
Oh, 1 hour is not a lot of time, right? Yeah. Yeah. I do a lot of training in Sweden, so I have 2 days to smooth things out and repair when you're going too fast or you said something wrong or
when
you get feedback from. Yeah, so 1 hour is not a lot of time. So I tried to present, just tell the listeners what OrigoDB is.
Mm-hmm.
So just explain the concept and just so that show them also Redis, what it is and how it works, and SQL Server Hackathon, how that works. The in-memory OLTP feature of SQL Server, which is pretty cool.
Okay.
Yeah, so I just tried to show those three. But the common thing, my message from the talk was like, your data probably fits in RAM. Yeah, and RAM is cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah, so do that. Yeah, you don't have to use my product, but like find other products that do or do it yourself or whatever, because it's just so crazy fast, and it's you get it for free.
So you mentioned you talked about Redis and SQL Hackathon.
Yeah.
Hackathon is one. Hackathon, right?
No, Hackathon. Hackathon was a code
Hackathon.
Name.
Hackathon,
yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And that's Greek from the Greek prefix for 100.
Okay.
Yeah? You guys don't do the metrics system
no,
in the
unfortunately.
US, right? Yeah. So, and that was kind of the goal was to have a 100 times performance increase. Yeah.
Okay. How would I compare that? Like you said, you compared with Redis and Hackathon. How do those compare? How?
Okay, well,
does it show?
Well, let's start with SQL Server. Most of you are familiar with it. We have a relational model, and we have our SQL as a query language, and it's pretty well established, right? And it's powerful. We can create indexes. We can do ad hoc queries, and there's so much tooling around operations, knowledge, and it's not going away yet, right? But it's kind of an obsolete. Not really at the logical level, but at the implementation level. The B-tree is so coupled to disk-based storage, so it's not really optimal. And so what the team did, they built an entirely new engine where they keep the data in RAM, and they represent it optimally for RAM. There's no coupling to disk.
Okay.
And they do logging as well, kind of like the same type of operation logging. So it's a completely new engine, separate. And you can choose which tables you wish to have as in memory, and you communicate with them in the same way with SQL, with insert, select, update, and you can join across in memory and non in memory tables. So it's kind of a hybrid. You choose which tables you want to pull into memory, and you can utilize the power of in memory, and you don't have to pull all your data from the entire database.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's great, and then you can use all the existing infrastructure and all the knowledge and operational things that go, and you can use your existing tooling like reporting stuff.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so it's just a powerful ecosystem that's really mature, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
But the trade-off is that it seems kind of bolted on a little bit, whereas Rigo is more like built from the ground up as it's an in-memory database.
Yeah, it's all in. Yeah. There are other vendors. There's one called VoltDB, really exciting startup.
Uh-huh.
They built an in-memory relational from scratch, kind of like the SQL Server team did.
Yeah.
But they have two engines side by side.
Huh.
Yeah, but no, SQL does, right?
Oh,
but
right.
VoltDB, they have just one single. It's all in-memory, and it's distributed as well.
And then Redis. How do we compare Redis with Rigo?
Yeah, well, Redis is it's a key-value store, and most people use it just as a cache.
Right.
They probably don't keep it persistent. When the system starts up, they start up with an empty cache and they start using it as the cache. That's the most normal use case, I think. But the values are in themselves complex structures. They're not just simple byte arrays or something.
It's like JSON or whatever, right?
Well, Redis has predefined structures.
Oh, right.
So the value behind a single key could be a hash table.
Okay.
Yeah. So, or it could be a list or a queue. Or a sorted set.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like complex structures, like data collections behind each key. And you can do fairly complex things with that. But basically, it's a key value store.
Okay.
And you said there's a bunch of predefined commands that you send. It kind of looks like an assembler.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like to call it the assembler of databases. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow. One other question I had is, can I represent it's been a while since I did serialization. I remember there were some things that I struggled with to serialize, and there were some formats and some whatever objects that were difficult to serialize, right? Is it just any serializable object that I, or, you know, what, how am I, is it, do I just create a POCO object and throw it in? Or?
Yeah. Well, if you're using the default serialization, it's binary formatting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's built into the framework. And that requires you tag your types with the serializable attribute. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the types in the .NET framework are serializable as well as the collections.
Okay.
Yeah. So use that. But if you're using Protobuf, then you have to create a mapping, and you can do that with attributes on your types, or you can create a separate mapping, a type mapping object that describes describes the serialization.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is really interesting. I'm looking forward to trying it out. Is there anything else you'd like to say or things you'd like to point listeners to?
Oh. No.
Okay.
That's all right. Great. Yeah.
So we'll have the link in the show notes.
Okay, great.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. Good.